From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Today, President-elect Joe Biden unveiled a coronavirus task force to help his transition team prepare to assume office in January. And when they do, the new administration will face a pandemic that has already claimed more than 237,000 lives in the U.S., and which appears to be getting worse fast. Yesterday was the fifth day in a row that the country exceeded 100,000 new coronavirus cases in a single day.
Which is why, Peter, you know, it was such welcome news today from Pfizer and BioNTech that their vaccine was more than 90% effective in a trial involving tens of thousands of volunteers. Dr. Krutika Kupalli is assistant professor at the Medical University of South Carolina, vice chair of the Global Health Committee at the Infectious Diseases Society of America. And doctor, on Twitter, you call this a reason to have hope. And right now we all need to have hope after a tough year. It is a big deal?
Well, yes, this is cautious optimism amidst a very difficult year for everybody. The early analysis of the Pfizer vaccine shows that when people receive two doses of the vaccine 3 weeks apart, those who received the vaccine experienced more than 90% fewer cases. The caveat being that this phase three trial is still ongoing. There's still much information to understand regarding the trial, and the data is still not final. So if this data holds up when the trial is complete, this will be very good news.
Yeah. But there are also a lot of questions. You know, for instance, what are their possible long-term effects? What are the questions do you have?
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of questions. Like I said, we still don't have the final phase three trial. We don't know how long this vaccine would potentially protect people. We don't know about the side effects of the vaccine. We do know that, some of the side effects are body aches and fevers. We don't know how effective it is in people of different ages. The people who have underlying health conditions. And also, this is a vaccine that has cold storage issues. So they have to be in freezers that are at minus 80 degrees. And so those would be other issues in terms of rolling it out. So there are lots of questions that we still don't know and a lot of information we still need to obtain regarding the clinical trial.
Well, and even if everything keeps going apace, it's still going to take quite a while, right, to get through the process?
Yes, right. Like I said, nobody's actually seen the data. So those of us in the scientific community would want to actually look at the data. This was data that came out via press release. So we would want to look at the data, make sure that it's transparent. And then once it goes through the FDA approval process, we have to roll it out. And then, again, it's not going to be available to everyone right away. It would be coming out in a tiered response, so primarily first to healthcare workers and those at highest vulnerability. So all that's going to take time.
Right.
Again, this is cautious optimism based on some potentially exciting news, which is, again, something that we all need after a very difficult year.
But it's not enough. It's not enough. And it's going to be great down the road. But right now, the pandemic is entering a deadly new phase. As you well know, the country's seven-day average of new daily cases topped 100,000 for the first time. Ashish Jha, one of the faces of the pandemic, the dean of Brown University School of Public Health, he tweeted out, "We should not accept that the Trump team will do nothing. We pay them, and people have to do something now." He, for instance, urged more money for testing. What do you think is needed right now with this surge?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. We cannot just sit back and wait for the Biden administration to assume the presidency on January 20th. We need to take action now. The case counts are extremely concerning, and looking ahead towards Thanksgiving and Christmas, we expect them to continue to go up. And so really, I implore everybody to take some personal responsibility for their actions. We need to increase testing. We need to limit the size of crowds and gatherings to no more than five people. We need people to remain distant. We need people to wear masks. Those are all things that are very important. There are only 33 states that have mask mandates. These are all things that we know that work, and we need people to do these things.
Yeah. Well, and Ashish Jha again said that he thinks that if these things aren't done as we wait for a vaccine, he wouldn't be surprised if we reached more than 2,000 deaths a day by December. That's just a month. Dr. Kritika Kupali, assistant professor at the Medical University of South Carolina, vice chair of the Global Health Committee at the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Doctor, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, as Joe Biden prepares his coronavirus response team, President Trump still hasn't conceded the race, and many Republicans are supporting him. Congressman Gary Palmer, Republican of Alabama, joins us now. Congressman, thanks for being here.
Good to speak with you, Peter.
And is it time for President Trump to concede this election?
I don't think so. I think we need to go through the litigation process, let that work itself out, and then whatever the determination is, then we'll abide by it.
Yeah, well, some of the president's close advisors are telling him to fight on. Others, like Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey, told CBS News that there's simply no evidence of fraud or wrongdoing. The president's own friend, Governor Chris Christie, has said that if there's evidence of fraud or wrongdoing in this election, show us. So where is the evidence?
Well, the evidence is in the fact that there were over 100,000 provisional ballots in Pennsylvania. There's questions about the validity of some of the late arriving ballots in Georgia. The real problem here, Peter, is our ability to conduct honest elections. There's some issues here that have to be addressed if we're going to continue the process of electing our representatives and really our president. We've had these arguments in court before, but there's got to be some uniformity in the process, and you can't have elections that last for days where it gives the impression that one side will count till they win.
Well, sir, I mean, I'm sure you know that it is perfectly legal to count ballots after election day. That's a completely normal process. And exhausting legal challenges, seeking recounts in a close race, that is one thing. But there is no widespread evidence of any meaningful wrongdoing in this election. I mean, nobody has been able to come up with anything meaningful. Even President Bush, former President Bush, and Senator Mitt Romney acknowledge that the president is within his rights to do some of these legal challenges. But if there's no evidence, it is bad for the country to keep this process going and to not concede.
What's bad for the country is to conduct elections that people have no confidence in, Peter. And I think we're on the verge of a constitutional crisis because you've got states that are changing laws and while votes are literally being cast. But I think the bigger point here is that you've got to have uniformity in election law, particularly when it comes to choosing a president.
If you continue to claim that the election was fraudulent, aren't you also running the risk of discrediting the gains that Republicans made in the House, for instance, and the relatively strong showing that Republicans had in the Senate this election?
No, I don't think so. Peter, I think the issue is much bigger than Biden and Trump. It's about whether or not the United States can conduct an election that people can trust.
Do you see any possibility that any of the legal challenges that are pending now could change the outcome of this race?
Well, I think that there needs to be some close scrutiny applied to how ballots were handled in several states. And once you go through that process and a decision is made, then you've got to abide by the decision.
At that point, you would recommend that the president concede if that's the way the courts rule?
Well, if the evidence shows that, I think that Joe Biden won fair and square, then I think we've got to have a peaceful transition.
Congressman Gary Palmer, Republican of Alabama, thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
And let's bring in NPR's Miles Parks now. He's been covering the voting process. And Miles, what Congressman Palmer said there sounds a lot like what other Republicans are saying today. What did you hear?
It does. Yeah, I hear allusions to questions, to shady behavior, but I still don't hear any actual evidence of any wrongdoing in this election. And, you know, the congressman talks about the fact that there's no confidence in this election process. Election administrators seem to have a lot of confidence in it. It seems like it's Republicans and President Trump who are driving these doubts, not the experts and the officials who are actually administering the process.
Yeah, he said that he was concerned about 100,000 provisional ballots in Pennsylvania, had questions about late arriving ballots in Georgia. Please, more context there, because, again, no reason to believe that there's anything suspicious going on with those ballots, right?
Yeah, and we always knew that this election would probably see more provisional ballots than ever before, specifically because of the expansion of vote by mail. In a state like Pennsylvania, you cannot, if you requested an absentee ballot and then you show up on election day to vote, either because you didn't receive it, something happened to the envelope, any number of reasons, you have to vote a provisional ballot on election day. So that has led to this huge uptick in provisional ballots in Pennsylvania specifically. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, we just have about 30 seconds here. But he also said that states were changing laws while votes were being cast. Again, not true, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, what he's saying is that absentee ballots went out in late September. A lot of election officials were still kind of jockeying within the courts about rules and deadlines, but those were on the margins. It's not like election officials were saying, oh, you're in line, you can't vote today on election day, we've changed the deadline to 3 p.m. or something like that. This is just kind of normal stuff that was happening in October once absentee ballots had already gone out. Nothing really, no huge issues there.
NPR's Miles Parks, thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
And it's been 2 days since Joe Biden was determined the president-elect, the 46th president of the United States, winning more than 270 electoral college votes needed to secure the presidency, leading in the popular vote by about 4.5 million. Today, we're going to begin a check-in with voters later in the program. We'll hear from a black activist in Georgia, where two Senate races are in runoffs. But right now, we want to visit again some of our previous guests, and we're going to start with Anne Ragosta. She's a former federal agent, mother of three in Milford, Massachusetts. We first met Anne when she turned out for a big caravan for President Trump here in the Massachusetts area. And Anne, as you expressed to us then, a huge supporter of President Trump. Your thoughts today?
Well, obviously, I am not kicking up my heels in joy. But that being said, I think I'm approaching the outcome a little bit more cautiously, not jumping to the same conclusion that the media has jumped to necessarily, particularly since there seems to be some indicia of fraud or irregularities. You know, would I prefer to be in Joe Biden's camp right now? Of course. But I do think once everything is adjudicated, once it's adjudicated properly, I think we might see something different. I'm not saying we necessarily will, but I like to hearken back to the Gore Bush, Florida Supreme Court decision. So my mood is more cautiously optimistic. And if Trump supporters feel that it's been a free and fair election, we wipe away our tears and pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and move forward.
Well, I mean, I hear everything you're saying. And you mentioned Florida, the difference being that was an incredibly razor-tight race in which it did come down to the counting of ballots in just one section of Florida. That's how tight the Electoral College race can be. This is an overwhelming victory. Joe Biden had the most votes cast in history, 4.5 million ahead of Donald Trump, who had the second most votes cast in history. He did quite well, actually, just did not win. There's just been no evidence of any widespread fraud, none.
I will say this. I mean, clearly the popular vote doesn't matter. You don't, if you take away California and New York and those highly, highly populated states, you don't come to the same millions and millions of more votes cast for Joe Biden. Secondly, when you talk about systemic fraud or the lack thereof, first of all, we don't know that. I think that, again, still needs to be adjudicated. Where there is indicia of fraud and irregularities, there is usually fraud in irregularities. I don't think Donald Trump is a sore loser. I mean, we heard Hillary Clinton shout to the rooftops a month ago, Joe Biden should not concede until the last ballot is counted. So why I don't understand why someone would be deemed to be a sore loser, because they're availing themselves of, you know, every legal remedy to ensure that it is a fair election.
Again, just there's just no evidence. But you say, well, Wayne Mel.
Oh, I think you're wrong. I disagree. I think there is absolutely evidence.
I hear, yep. Well, what do you see? If there is no proof of fraud and this stands, Are you willing to give a President Joe Biden a chance?
I don't think so, only because I listen carefully to what his policies are going to be. I completely disagree with virtually every one of his policy pronouncements. And let me just close with this. I think the biggest fraud that has been perpetrated in this election cycle has been the fraud by the mainstream media against the American public for really, truly lying about this president's accomplishments and lying about him being a racist and a homophobe. 50% of Americans think it's appalling.
And obviously a tough day for you. So thank you for speaking with us.
No, not yet. Milton.
Oh, not yet. Okay.
Again, not
all right.
Yet.
All right. Republican, President, strong President Trump backer, Milford, Massachusetts voter Anne Rogasta. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, now let's go to New Hampshire. Katherine Johnson grew up in a Republican family there. Her father was a judge, chair of the state's party. But after Donald Trump won the nomination in 2016, she campaigned for Democrats. And Katherine, when last we spoke with you, you actually broke down in tears speaking of Donald Trump and what you feared was his impact on the party of your, you know, ancestors. How do you feel after this weekend's election?
Well, first, I hope you can hear it in my voice. I am so happy. And I think that my father would be incredibly proud of the turnout. I mean, to see this many people come out in this election.
But what would you say to people in the party of your father, you know, that your father loved, the Republican Party, who are not conceding this election, as we just heard, think that there possibly might have been fraud, don't feel they can accept a President Biden? What would you say?
You know, first of all, when it comes to calling the elections, unless I'm wrong, I think we've always had the elections called by the media, and then we go through the whole electoral verification process. I think when it comes to the 70 million, you know, voters, I think it's time to decide if you're Republicans or Trump Republicans. I mean, if you look at how they did down ballot, the Republicans did very well. So one of the things I think they should ask themselves is if their candidates all did so well up and down the ticket, how come Donald Trump lost? They lost because many of those people who are true Republicans, that they voted for their candidates. But then when it came to the top of the ticket, they voted for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris because they're sick of the rhetoric. They're sick of the tweets. They're sick of the lack of compassion and racial unrest. I mean, this president spent the weekend golfing again. I mean, and Joe Biden's put together a corona advisory task force with scientists. I mean, I've never had so much hope in my life. So I think that Republicans really need to ask themselves, are you going to believe the facts or are you going to believe the alternative facts? If I could say anything to Donald Trump, please, sir, please have class and please concede with dignity.
That's Katherine Johnson, again, from a family, longtime Republican in New Hampshire. Katherine, thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's go now to Lexington, Kentucky, where Beth Howard is an organizing director of Southern Crossroads. She's the white daughter of a former strip miner. Her group works for racial justice. We spoke with her and a member of Southern Crossroads after she also started the group Rednecks for Black Lives Matter in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. And Beth joins us now. Beth, how are you feeling about this election?
Well, today I wanted to say that Trump has been defeated and we are thrilled. And that was crucial. And just acknowledging that that was led by Black organizers and especially Black women, and that we are going to stay vigilant until Inauguration Day. But yes, to follow up on our conversation, that assessment to me still feels really true. And also building multiracial alliances of poor and working people in the South. It works. And I think we saw that in Georgia. And so I'm really looking to Georgia and looking at the work that we've laid out for ourselves as a strategy to win back the South. And both political parties are run by billionaires. And so we do see our work as being the same. And that means that we are going to be pushing for, you know, safe housing for everyone, healthcare, you know, food and shelter, safety. And I really want to lift up the importance of the South. I want people to know that the South is worth investing in. W.E. Du Bois, who is a Black Southerner, civil rights activist, said, as the South goes, so goes the nation. And that is still true. And so I really want to talk about, you know, if we want to defeat the far right in this country, we have to defeat them here in the South where they're the strongest. And I do believe we do that by organizing poor people around mutual interest issues, town by town. And that's what we saw in Georgia. You know, Georgia is not a fluke or a miracle. It was organizing with that exact plan in mind. And so what we did, Southern Crossroads did, I want to talk about that because I think it's such important data. You know, Georgia turned into a swing state when many people would have written it off. And I know a lot of people are seeing this high number of Trump voters who are white. And many white people are, you know, that's upsetting to see. And there's a lot of worry around that. And I think that we stick to our plan that works. So in Georgia, we followed the leadership and worked alongside the New Georgia Project, so following Black leadership. And along with showing up for racial justice, Southern Crossroads, we made thousands and thousands of calls to poor white voters in Georgia. And we didn't call Trump voters. You know, we didn't try to pull them away from Trump. We called voters that sit it out in most elections and people who both parties ignore. And what we're seeing, the data from there, is that we're seeing that we had gains in majority white counties in Georgia. And that is because of the work of, you know, Black-led organizing and then the white people like us who showed up and did our part.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is one thing you take from this election is don't ignore voters. Don't ignore them.
Yeah, absolutely, Robin. Don't ignore us. Don't count us out. And I wanted to say, as an Appalachian woman from a working class family, working class rural folks, that I'm hearing many liberals and many people wanting to blame poor white people in the South. They call us uneducated, ignorant, and backwards. And it really undermines our ability to bring our communities into this movement, and the right weaponizes it. And so I want to ask people to interrupt those narratives when you see them and within ourselves, because we don't want to do the right's work for them. And this is our work for the long haul. So here at Southern Crossroads, and for me, we're just going to keep organizing.
Beth Howard, Organizing Director of Southern Crossroads, the not-for-profit advocating for social and racial justice, talking to us there from Kentucky. Beth, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And that's just a sample of voter voices. We'll hear more in the program, but also in the coming days. And right now, if you'd like to weigh in, go to hereandnow.org. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Here and Now.
The stock market is surging to record highs today on news that Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine is 90% effective. Wall Street is also responding to Joe Biden's victory, even as President Trump vows to keep fighting the outcome of the election. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So, wow, the Dow soared more than 5% at the open on this Pfizer vaccine news. But do you think that the market's response is a little premature here?
I mean, it could be. I still believe that this is an unequivocal good news. It really is. And for the virus and the tamping down of the virus. But there is a concern that we are not going to necessarily have the widespread distribution of a vaccine and have everybody get vaccinated who needs to get vaccinated in a really short period of time. So what does that mean? It leaves us in this period, almost the in-between period, where we are suffering from a spike in virus cases. We are seeing parts of the economy re-shut down again. And we have more than 10 million people who are still out of work. And all those people and all those facts exist. And so we've got an economy that is still suffering the effects of the pandemic.
Well, and exactly. That's why I'm looking at these numbers. American Airlines jumped 22%, United 23%, Carnival, the cruise ship operator, up 36%. I mean, it's not as if we're going to wake up tomorrow and everything is going to be fine. I mean, these companies still have a long road ahead of them.
Yes, and I think that that's really the issue. And you know, frankly, a lot of the trends that have developed amid the pandemic are not necessarily going to reverse course immediately. I wonder if perhaps investors, this is a bit of pent-up demand of good news and optimism. Listen, stock investors are notoriously upbeat. But I also think that there is a sense that that an investor who looks at the markets today is not looking at what's happening today. They're looking at not 6 weeks in the future, it's 6 years in the future.
Well, here's another wild card. President Trump hasn't conceded yet, and there's a chance that the next few months of transition could be pretty tumultuous. What kind of impact do you think that might have?
Well, I think the uncertainty would be pretty bad for markets. One of the things that we saw last week, which was also a great week for stock investors, by the way, the best election week since 1932. But last week, you saw sentiment shift where investors at least looked at an election that would not be long drawn out or contested. There was a belief that Biden and Harris had won, that the Senate would likely remain as a Republican-controlled Senate, that the House was definitely going to remain as a Democratic House, and that that combination would essentially mean that things would go pretty slowly, that there wouldn't be an immediate tax increase on corporations or the wealthiest 2% of individuals, and that anything that would go through a split Congress would take some time and wouldn't probably be as big as feared by many investors.
So in other words, gridlock, not so bad in their eyes.
Yeah, I mean, the one I would say that gridlock from the investment perspective is usually pretty good. Gridlock for the real economy may not be good because we still do need stimulus. Remember, we've got to fill the gap between where we are today and when that vaccine becomes widely available.
CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger, host of Jill on Money. Thank you, as always.
Thanks so much.
Along with the promising results on a possible COVID-19 vaccine, we're also watching as the coronavirus continues to surge in the U.S. and around the world. Portugal and Hungary today became the latest European countries to impose curfews to slow down infections. Like other European countries, Portugal has seen new cases and hospital admissions spike in recent weeks. Portugal imposed a state of emergency and ordered some 7 million people to stay at home on weeknights between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. That curfew will be in effect for at least the next 2 weeks. And in Hungary, that country's curfew amounts to its strictest measures so far in the pandemic. So we'll watch as that story develops. And in the meantime, we're going to take a break from the news to hear some music. Here in Now's Alex Ashlock reminds us of a band from the American South whose legacy is being freshly appreciated today.
The B-52s.
Rock pop star.
And later, R.E.M. These two bands were instrumental in putting Athens, Georgia on the musical map a few decades ago, but it was another band who just may have been everyone's favorite in that southern city. They called themselves Pylon. Rolling Stone magazine dubbed Pylon's Cool one of the top 100 debut singles of all time, and it's one of the 47 tracks on the just-released Pylon box. It's a set that collects the band's two studio albums, Gyrate and Chomp, which have been remastered, plus a bunch of unreleased recordings. Michael Lahusky played bass in Pylon.
I'm just excited that there's a conversation about our music and that it's back on, or it will be, I guess, in full on the release date, back on social media, on streaming, you know, on streaming services, music services. And so hopefully it'll be accessible to a lot of people and maybe inspire some people and their own creativity.
Creativity is certainly what happened when Lahusky, Randy Bewley, Curtis Crowe, and Vanessa Briscoe Hay put this band together in the late 1970s. They weren't musicians. They were art students at the University of Georgia. And they had this idea that maybe not being musicians might be a good foundation for a band, that not knowing what they were supposed to be doing might lead to new ideas. So LaHusky bought a $35 bass guitar from a pawn shop. Randy bought a cheap guitar there, too. And they started learning how to make their instruments sound good, even if they technically didn't know how to play them. Curtis Crowe joined them on drums, and they asked Vanessa, their friend, to sing.
And it just kind of gelled into its own language and had its own inherent energy that really was just hard to predict exactly how it was going to all come together. You know, I think our conviction is what carried us through.
Pylon took its name from the safety cones that cordoned off areas at the DuPont textile plant where they worked part-time, always sure to wear their safety glasses and steel-toed boots. In an early press release, Pylon described their music as feasible rock and said they were concerned with caution, but also adventure. They called this song Precaution. Vanessa Briscoe-Hay says she approached the lyrics and songs Pylon wrote and played like she would approach what she was familiar with, an art project.
One of our professors had told us, you know, a drawing can be finished with the first gesture. And so that first gesture is important. And also how you end it is important. So I just tried to find myself, like, within the framework of the song, I would try to make something that fit.
Pylon's sweaty, kinetic live performances cemented their reputation. Bill Berry, the drummer for that other Athens band, R.E.M., called Pylon the best live band he'd ever seen. R.E.M. even covered one of Pylon's songs called Crazy. R.E.M. guitarist Peter Buck wrote that he heard Pylon's version of Crazy on the radio the same day his band's Chronic Town EP was released, and he was suddenly depressed by how much better Pylon's record was than his band's. But as good as the band's fans thought Pylon was, LaHusky says they were never in it for the long run. Music wasn't going to be a career for them.
It kept us going for a while. I think we eventually sort of ran up against the expectations of the music business as kind of a business. We didn't hang in there real long, but we had a wonderful run that went, you know, years beyond our initial expectations, I would imagine.
Pylon was popular enough to land a spot opening for U2, but they only played a few shows on that 1983 tour. Pylon played its last show at the Mad Hatter in Athens on December 1st of that year. Since then, there have been a few reunions and a new record called Chain, but Vanessa Briscoe-Hay says ending the band in 1983 was the right call.
At the time, we made that decision together. And for better or for worse, it was our decision and we made it. It wasn't something that someone made for us.
Briscoe-Hay started a family and also became a nurse. These days, she still sings for a band called the Pylon Reenactment Society. But she says there's one bittersweet aspect to the new attention Pylon is receiving right now because of this new box set.
But the main thing that's important to me is that our bandmate who was passed on, Randy Bewley, will be remembered. He was such an incredible and gifted guitarist. He was a sculpture major, and he didn't know how to make chords or any of this stuff. He made some incredible sounds. So to me, it's very important that Randy especially be remembered.
Pylon guitarist Randy Bewley had a heart attack and died in 2009. He was 53. Music journalist Steven Deusner compares Pylon to the Monkees or the Archies. They were a gang, and they did everything together. Michael Lahusky says that was really true, especially when Pylon was on the road, spending long hours in their vans between shows.
I think that all contributed that when we got on stage to perform, we were all coming from the same place. We weren't trying to figure out what each other had been doing all day or something. We were all there, all together, and it was a ramp towards the performance, and that's where all of our energy went, was just to that part of the day, the performance.
Lahusky and Vanessa Briscoe-Hay still live where Pylon started. Michael works at the Georgia Museum of Art at the University of Georgia in Athens, which is also home to a collection of Pylon's artifacts and images. Many of them are featured in a book that comes with this new box set. Flipping the pages is like looking through a family's photo album. It tells the story of a band called Pylon. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashley.
As President-elect Joe Biden prepares to transition to the White House, we're looking closer at the data of the election, something Democrats in particular might want to pay attention to. It's early days, but it's showing a shifting political divide. It seems to be showing a polarization of place, but a depolarization of race. Let's explain that with Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us every Monday. So, Derek, start with the explanation. Depolarization of race. You're talking about Black and Latino voters. With the caveat, Latino voters are not a monolith, but what are you and others seeing?
So Democrats have historically won about 90% of the Black vote and about 60 to 70% of the Latino vote. And as you said, race, ethnicity, these are sometimes constructs that demographers or anybody else uses to group people who shouldn't necessarily be grouped. But for the purposes of this conversation, we're talking about two groups of non-white voters that Democrats have historically won. But initial returns suggest that Joe Biden might have actually lost ground among these non-white voters. The most obvious drift is in Florida, where Biden rather famously at this point underperformed in heavily Latino counties like Miami-Dade. This is true really across the Southeast. Majority precincts in Florida and Georgia and South Carolina seem to have swung toward Republicans. And in Southern Texas, we saw the same thing. Trump outperforming his 2016 returns in heavily Latino counties in the Rio Grande Valley. So you see really across the country, and most importantly across the South in these Southern swing states, the Latino vote rather surprisingly swing toward Donald Trump, while at the same time, a lot of white Americans living in inner suburbs voted for Joe Biden at a much higher clip than they voted for Hillary Clinton. So what you essentially saw here is non-white voters and white voters move a little bit more toward the middle. That is the depolarization of race that I discussed in my piece and that you just alluded to.
Well, and we should say that many Latinos who came from countries where socialism is a bad word responded to that. There's that. Mm. But these are trends, as you say. This is not just this election. Something that jumped out of me, you quote the pollster David Shore, who said, I think it was absolutely clear in 2018 that non-white voters were trending Republican, and we're seeing this in 2020 polling. There's no denial about this fact. Non-white voters trending Republican.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting, and I think a little bit counterintuitive, because I think a lot of people are holding on to a narrative that is eroding a little bit. And that narrative is that, you know, Republicans win white voters and Democrats' base is among non-white voters. Now, to a certain extent, that is true. I mean, Democrats are going to win in this cycle probably somewhere between 85 and, you know, 90% of Black voters. That is an enormous margin. But at the same time, it's shifting a little bit toward Republicans. And I think that's an important thing to focus on. It suggests that we shouldn't necessarily think of these categories as monoliths that are going to vote the way they voted in 2008 forever. You're going to see shifts at the margins, and those shifts at the margins can determine who wins and loses the Senate, the Congress, and the White House.
Well, that brings us to polarization of place. This is the urban-rural divide, longtime trend. And you're saying Wisconsin is a good example of what's happening in that category in 2020. Why?
Yeah. The upshot here is basically that rural areas are racing toward the Republican Party while metro areas are moving to the left toward the Democratic Party. And Wisconsin offers just a fascinating example of this. So you go back to the beginning of the century in 2000. Al Gore won the largest county in Pennsylvania, Milwaukee, by about 20 percentage points. He got creamed in the white, wealthy suburbs of Milwaukee. And then he eked out a victory in rural areas like Pepin County, the birthplace of Laura Ingalls Wilder, the author of Little House on the Prairie. Meanwhile, Biden did much better than Gore in Milwaukee. He doubled the margin from 20 to 40 points. He actually narrowed the gap in Waukesha as college-educated whites moved toward the Democratic Party. But then Trump cleaned up in rural counties, which made the vote again so narrow. So what's so fascinating about Wisconsin is that this is a state that has been decided by less than one percentage point four times in the last six elections. But the distribution of votes has changed immensely within that period, with Democrats now basically controlling metro areas and Republicans doing really, really well in rural areas. That is the polarization of place.
Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, we just say you also conclude not a bad thing that one party that is seen as demonizing people of color may be shifting. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
We want to take a minute now to note the loss of Alex Trebek, the longtime host of the game show Jeopardy, who died after a battle with pancreatic cancer at 80. We remember a speech he gave after winning the Americanism Medal last year from the Daughters of the American Revolution. It's given to naturalized American citizens for their outstanding contributions to the U.S. And Trebek, as fans know, was born in Canada. He spoke about it only takes a single step for Americans to make the world a better place, as he pointed to his head and his heart.
I think all of us need to look at our country and figure out whether America lives up to the ideal America that we have here and here. If it doesn't, if there's room for improvement, and there always is, let us act.
The words of the late Alex Trebek, who again died at 80 after decades of enjoyment, giving enjoyment to Americans. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. What's next for the transition of power as President-elect Joe Biden starts to build his cabinet, and ballot counting and lawsuits continue? That's next time on Here and Now.